Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
He's PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
The one and only.
This is the Books Boys show. Get it, buy it, books.
Books. What's it all about, Dean?
Well, I'm more worried about, do you know the catchphrase? Because we had some difficulty with you in a forest.
Okay, right. I was getting very confused between get it, buy it, sell it.
Books. Read it. Enjoy, read it. But no, I don't know.
Well, it's all very confusing. You see, I think part of the confusion stems from the fact that I'm still looking at the toilet section of the supermarket. And between the tooth floss and the toothpaste, I've been looking for Dante's Complete Works. And all I could find was literally hell. And I thought I was in purgatory and heaven was nowhere in sight. So I was very confused.
Hmm.
So if anyone can help me find Dante's works of great art. Maybe it's in the fruit section. Maybe it's considered very fruity. I don't know. I can't find it in the old supermarkets. And
it's,
I thought
it's
that's
difficult to ascertain. It's whereabouts. Where is Dante hanging out?
Where is he? I think that could be the catchphrase of the month. So that's the dilemma. How have you, Dean? Apart from the forest wanderings, and should we
I'm
tell
good.
The?
Yeah, tell so the... we'll tell them. Yeah, so us yeah. And also Playboy Alex from our Shakespeare show on Patreon. We all went, had a nice little day in Newcastle on the beach and in the forest.
Nice.
Now, there was one point where you were washing your hair in the river, Alex was up a tree, and I was doing inappropriate things with a belt. And I don't know what was happening there.
I'm not sure where it went. It went a bit risque, I thought. There, yeah. I wasn't sure what kind of playboy this was supposed to be. You know what I mean? I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, I was getting a little bit... Passers-by were confused.
And it was Newcastle, not very confusingly. It wasn't Newcastle in England, where I thought
Northern
we
Irish
might have
Newcastle.
Been heading
yeah.
with the bus. So it was all very spontaneous. I wasn't expecting to join them, but it happened to just all flow very naturally. And it was a very Shakespearean day. It sounds like a joke, but we literally were talking about Shakespeare about 80% of the time. It sounds
very... Yeah, we did. We did. People on the bus did not like us.
No, I don't. Very surprisingly, they did not seem to appreciate the free and live episode of Books Boys / Playboys they were getting. So,
free content. They should be paying our ticket for that.
Talking about free content, almost free content, they're paying a minimal fee. Why don't you sign up for a total of, I believe, is it how many? 73 episodes?
At the moment on patreon.com/booksboys, there are more than 80. It was 84,
wow.
Plus now this is a new episode and there's probably been something else since then I've forgotten about. So, like, yeah, by the end of this month, it's going to be 90 probably, you know, by the time the next episode comes out. So,
and we have reviewed a few plays as well. In fact, the Playboys got together, the three of us, and reviewed Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House. And also, Dean and I teamed up and we did JC, not Jesus Christ. The other one, Julius Caesar.
The other one, Julius Caesar. That's right. So those are both coming out soon as well.
So join us for some amazing, almost free content for, I believe, only £3.50, or is it?
£2.50 or $3. I guess that's
$3.
About €3. You get this show early, and you also get all of our other shows, Playboys, there's some Film Fellows, Poetry Pals, Caper Captains.
Yeah.
There's so much different stuff on there. As we said, there's almost 90 episodes of various different things. rock star interviews that I did with musicians. You know, there's lots of stuff on there.
And very importantly, the GC is coming up for Shakespearean, well, for anyone who's doing the Leaving Cert. And I'm just, if you're looking for some free content, not, again, sorry, I keep saying free because it's almost free, $3.
It is almost free. Like, if it was any cheaper, we'd be paying you. That's...
Anyway, keeping that in mind, we did review the four plays that are being, or is it five plays that are being reviewed for GCSE?
We did the four that were on the A level, and we also did a couple of others that are sometimes on GCSE. So if you're studying Shakespeare in school in the UK, we've probably covered the material that you need.
Because I think we have now 14 of Shakespeare's plays reviewed,
yeah,
including almost all of the big ones and some minor ones as well.
I mean, just let me give you an example of April alone. We released Books Boys 18, and obviously that came out early. Interviews from the Vault with a nice little band called Walking for Pennies. We did Poetry Pals 3 because I did a little bit about Miguel Hernandez extra. Renaissance 2, The Jew of Malta, because we wanted to compare it with The Merchant of Venice. So that we also did Playboys 12, The Merchant of Venice.
And that was our second Marlowe play. We did the more famous one, Dr. Faustus.
We did.
Last year.
A while back. Then we also have the last episode of Dark Place Dreamers with Robert. We reviewed the final episode of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place with the cool song in it. If you want to see Moss from the IT Crowd rapping, you can get it there. So we did a lot. Also Film Fellows, Machete with Robert and Alex. So like, there's been 7 episodes this month alone, guys.
And not just to mention that, but we have got tons of stuff to review this month. It's been a very big one for me. I've read more than usual. Should we get straight to it? What I've got a lot of things to tell you that I haven't purposely mentioned that I think you'd be interested in it.
But I thought we were going to host first Dentistry Pals, because you were brushing your teeth before we went on air, right?
Indeed, I was brushing my teeth, because that's what the cool kids do. They brush teeth before they actually
He's very talk. Worried that, yeah, we couldn't talk on the Zoom without clean... We don't even have the video turned on, but we couldn't do audio without clean teeth.
So, it's our latest sponsor. Indeed.
We're sponsored by our good clean teeth.
Exactly, yes. Oh, Lord. So where to begin, Dean? Should I go first this time? Because I've got something
exciting
to tell you.
Go ahead. Take it away.
Well, last time I was talking about Carol Churchill. So again, Carol Churchill being a big feminist playwright from the UK. He started writing essentially in the 50s, actually, but really became big in the late 70s, 80s, especially his Top Girls of 1982, which is the one where it has a lot of historical female figures, some very feminist, some very repressed by men, all joining and in this one amazing play. So I decided to read more of her because I really enjoyed her play. And so I read the 2000s play Far Away. Now, Far Away is a shorter play that has only 4 characters: Harper, young Joanne as an adult, and Todd. Essentially, the whole play is very visual play about what a dystopian England could be like, and or a dystopian UK, I would say, a bit more general, with a lot of the Holocaust being replayed in a different, with different visuals, I would say. So essentially, it starts off in Harper's kitchen, and she is Joanne's aunt. And Joanne enters, and it's late in the night, and she tells step by step what she has seen throughout the night. And Harper, the aunt, is telling her, is kind of inventing the story as it goes, but changing it as Joanne tells, "Well, I've seen blood. Oh, that was just someone who fell. Then, well, I hear screams. Oh, that was just the night owls or something." And essentially, it ends up that what it seems to be, but we're left very confused because the story is constantly re-edited. That's what I find interesting about the play. The story is re-edited constantly by what Harper hears about Joanne telling. Mm-hmm. And essentially it seems to be that Harper and her husband seem to be hiding refugees. And take into consideration it's 2000, so it's before really a lot of the refugees of the last 22 years crisis, but I suppose it might be influenced by the Yugoslavian war in the early 90s. But essentially, it's so vague that it could be anything. That's why it's a great play. You could turn it and talk about Ukraine now. It seems to be that Harper and her husband are protecting these in the barn, but it's left to some confusion, really, and you're not really trusting her, because in the end, it seems to be that Joanne also heard one of the kids being beaten to death. And all that Harper has to say at the end is simply that, well, you know, kids that don't behave, they get naughty things happen to mm-hmm. them. So essentially, once again, like Top Girls is a very risk role play that's left. It's very bloody. It's very messy. And Top Girls, without getting into it too much, there is a later scene in it where a young girl has her period and she's kind of comparing it with another girl. And to be honest, it's just very risk role. And again, this play shows it's very bloody. It's very much about themes that that you don't really want to even, I suppose, see or talk about. Blood being a big thing, just like here. It moves on without spoiling too much about the further acts. I would say that that's act one, sets the scene. But act two onwards, we've got Joanne being an adult and she's now a big hat maker. But essentially, this is all just a big farce, because she's a hat maker that just makes hats and hats and hats. And it all becomes like a bit of a farce. She ends up making a million hats, and that's all she's doing in her life. And she's talking with Todd, who's a co-worker, and it's just them. And eventually, they actually end up being married and just making hats. It becomes very absurd. So this is where I think, Dean, you might maybe perhaps not enjoy it too much, because you're not the biggest fan of Beckett. You're not the biggest fan of Waiting for Godot.
That's one way to say it, yeah.
Indeed. And just so you know, listeners, that was an episode that was never released, because I'm afraid me and Alex didn't get a chance to. We both love Waiting for Godot, and it ended up only Dean reading it at the time.
And I hated it, so I was swindled.
So we just didn't do the episode, but, you know, in a parallel universe. But it becomes very Beckett-esque, and the hats are used for a parade, but it ends up being when the parade happens, which is just a visual, I think it's scene five. Scene five has no dialogue. It's just a million people, or as many people as fit in into the scene, marching, but they look like prisoners, and they seem to be judged, and they're wearing the hats that are very colorful and playful, but they're kind of, it's implied that they might be burned, like, and killed. So very, so a lot of World War II scenarios here. Look, I won't lie to you, this is not a very light play, as you hear. This is not a cheery, oh, I'm feeling so great.
Pretty, heavy, yeah.
It's extremely heavy, and I'm not going to tell you what scene six is, of act two, sorry, or act three, but I want to leave it like that. All I can say is that I think what's powerful about the play is Cara Churchill. She's a great, she's great with language, not in the sense of that she might use kind of very loquacious words, but the way she just experiments around and makes it sound, she's more of a poet. And particularly in the last scene where everything culminates into a big, it becomes very brutal. And act three becomes very the most dystopian scene in it. So I won't tell you what it is, but it essentially becomes a dialogue between should I betray and save myself, or should I keep the secret to myself but risk my own life? And essentially, the whole play, which is called Far Away, is about things happening seemingly far away, and you trying to stay in your house and be unaware of it, but literally comes knocking at your door. The horror.
Right, so you can't even just keep to yourself and avoid things.
Indeed, yes. And that's on point. Sorry, I should have mentioned Harper, the aunt, lives far, far away in the countryside. That's how it begins. But literally, the horrors are so close by and they're just accumulating that no one is able to escape this dystopian society. And it's a very interesting, vague depiction of dystopian UK. And I think that's what's powerful about it, because it doesn't have to be UK anymore. It can be anything. It can turn about Ukraine, Russia.
Yeah, once you get into dystopia, you know, the setting isn't really that important. It reflects on any society, you know.
Indeed, yeah. So it's a powerful play. I think I prefer Top Girls. The only thing I say about Far Away, it's more of a visual play. I think I prefer to see it, whereas Top Girls is very enjoyable to read. It has more stories in it, in a sense. It had many stories in it. This is just one long kind of holocaust, so very difficult to read, I suppose. So that's the first play I read. So again, I recommend Card Shoujo for anyone who's interested in feminist theater. Please do give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good.
What were you yourself, Dean? What did you read? I'm going chronological, by the way. So that was the first thing I read.
Yeah, that's how I'm going to do it. The first thing I read was another Balzac. There is a trend here. Basically, my library membership to the university library runs out soon, and I'm trying to get all the Balzacs I can. So that's why there's been a lot lately, and there'll be more next month, and then it'll be finished.
So the guy wrote so much that he's, I think he's one of the most prolific authors ever. He got up at around 6 o'clock in the evening, got his coffee, and wrote and drank coffee all night to 6 o'clock in the morning, and then fell asleep. And that was the first 50 years of his life. I'm not sure if I told you this. And when he became 50, he fell in love with a Polish noblewoman. He fell in love with her a while ago, but they only got married after her husband passed on. And some years, so when he was 50, they at last got married. And he seemed to really be living the life and letting go of that just obsessive drinking coffee in poverty, kind of in poverty as well, even though he was a known author. He never seemed to hold on to money. And only in the last year of his life did he find love and then die at 51. I find it very both tragic and also beautiful that he managed to at least have 1 year of beauty in his life. But it just shows you, being a great author and writing many books is not, if it leads to a lifestyle of drinking coffee and staying in your bed kind of all night just writing, I'm not sure if I want that either,
That last year could be the only good one, maybe, that he had, which is a little bit sad. But
yeah, a bit, because, he seemed to have found true love. Anyway, that's my little anecdote about Balzac. So
part of the human comedy. It's Scenes from Private Life. It's called Lost Illusions. Do you know this one?
I've heard of it, yeah.
So, look, last month I wasn't really keen on the Balzac that I read, but this one I loved. It's brilliant. Obviously, it's your standard Parisian setting, but we begin out in the provinces. So the book's split up, and the first part is called Two Poets. So,
and should we just mention to listeners, again, if you follow our episode, you know, but the human comedy is a play on, again, Dante's Divine Comedy. So funny I referenced it.
Yeah.
But it's essentially a realism. It's essentially a realistic depiction of Parisian and around Paris lifestyle, like early 19th century to maybe 1830s, 40s. Am I right about this?
And the copy I had was very old, and it what made me sad was you can see in the beginning of the library book, how many stamps it's got and what date it's due back. Now, they stopped using that about around 10 to 15 years ago. Between the 50s and 2000, the early 2000s, the book was only taken out 4 times.
What?
Just very sad.
Oh my God. That's very sad. So anyway, you made it back a trend. Hopefully after this episode, this will become the next bestseller after.
It is, I think so.
The latest Tom Clancy novel.
So basically, these two poets, we have David Séchard and his friend Lucien Chardon. Now, David's father owns a printing business, but he's old and he's selling the business to his son, David. And he immediately sets his son up for failure by selling the business for a lot more than it's worth, not helping him with anything, and then leasing it back to him at exorbitant prices. So he really just sets his son up for failure immediately. And the dad's very, very selfish throughout the book. Lucien, however, is just this, quixotic, beautiful, reminds me a little bit of Dorian Gray. He's just this captivating, beautiful character. And his friend realizes, look, I'm going to hire you to be my foreman and I'll help you out, I'll give you a bit of a wage. And you're just so beautiful that I'm going to be subservient to you. That's the natural order of things, even though, I'm the boss. And I thought, I can understand this, And then he falls in love with Lucien's sister. And the two of them decide, let's get married, but let's do it for Lucien. He's so great. And the sister worships him as well. So they just say, let's just give him all our money. Let's have a house just for him. He can't be a foreman anymore. That's not good enough. We need to get him into society. So they just work hard and basically just to support Lucien's lifestyle. And he's just going to grand salons with a girl, Louise, who's a rich lady. And he's trying to impress all the high society. And then she says to him, well, let's go to Paris. So he has to abandon his friends, doesn't even go to his friend and sister's wedding. because he has to go to Paris with Louise, and he just fleeces them for all their money. He's like, look, guys, I need thousands of francs in order to go to Paris. And they just give him everything they have. And then he writes to them while he's in Paris asking for more money. He falls in with crowds, you know.
So far, it's a very... So far, it seems to be recycling the story of Le Père Goriot, Old Father Goriot.
There's similarities, definitely.
Old Father Goriot he's taking care of his daughters and paying everything he can so they can live a high lifestyle while he's poor.
Yeah, it is similar. Obviously, it's not the paternal relationship, it's a friend one, but it's the same,
Interesting, okay.
And he also takes it so far as to forge his friend's name on some checks.
Oh, no.
And the friend doesn't even mind. He's just like, yeah, but we need to support this beautiful man, you know?
Wow.
And he ends up in prison over it and everything. Like, it's ridiculous. And this guy's just so... These people are so loving, so caring, and he is just so selfish throughout the entire book.
This is, for me, very much, old man or old dad, Goryeo, in a sense, because the daughters were very selfish, too. They didn't really seem to care at all that he was in dire poverty.
No, they didn't. And there's these other publishers called the Quantets who are trying to put David out of business. And what they do is they completely monopolize the trade, but they give him just enough work to keep him not going bankrupt. Because if he goes bankrupt, someone better might come in, you know, who can run the business better and put them out of business. So they basically give him just 5% of the available work, just enough to keep him thinking that he can run the business without, you know, and put a bit of bread on the table, basically. While they make all the real money. And his father doesn't help him. He even goes to his father to say, I'm going to get married. And the first thing is, well, you're not getting any money. But the father is actually mega rich. And he sees the business struggling, knowing that he caused it, and just doesn't care. And he actually says at one point, I wish I could disinherit you without harming your wife or my newborn grandson. Like, he just has so little respect for his son. For no reason. The son never does anything wrong.
So is the later half of the book very tragic, like in the sense again of old Goryeo?
Bits of it are, yeah. I mean, David starts to try to invent a better way of printing that he thinks, this is near the end. He tries to invent a better way of printing that he thinks will make him money. And it's, you know, his dad doesn't even support him. And the Quantets, it's terrible. And there's a lot of legal maneuvering by crafty lawyers. But the massive middle part of the book is all taken up with Lucien in Paris. So as soon as he arrives, Louise immediately abandons him, and now he's just in Paris. He's begging money off everyone. He falls in with, you know, with a good crowd and with a bad crowd. He becomes a journalist and starts writing articles, criticizing people, and becomes a very well-known, you know, semi-famous journalist. Yeah. He's very successful, falls in love with an actress. But just the selfishness of everyone is ridiculous, you know? And obviously, well, I'm not going to say what happens in the end, but you almost don't want it to work out well for him. He's just swindling his friends, his sister, like his mother, like everyone, just to get money. And when he does get to Paris, all he cares about is like, do I have the finest clothes? Can I be a dandy? Can I stroll around? And he's trying to sell a poetry book and a book called An Archer of Charles the Ninth. So he's written some kind of Dumas-style history that he's trying to sell. And, you know, no one wants it. And then he realizes he can only get it sold if he's, you know, if he does corruption. So he has to publish articles that threaten the publisher, and they say, well, I'll stop it if you publish my book, and all this kind of stuff, you know. It's just all corruption, and he's shocked, but we see him gradually get corrupted, you know.
That's very Balzac, I guess, isn't it? You know, depicting really what the things that were happening at the time. It seemed very amazing, but I mean, if you think about a tabloid news, that's incredible too. You wouldn't think necessarily that. What I'm saying is that I think people in 50 years, and they'd be reading some kind of book we wrote, and we were just basing it on tabloid news, they'd also think like, that's just fiction. That's nonsense, you know. But it isn't. It's supposed to be realism. It's supposed to be realistic enough. Things happening behind the scenery that in romantic periods you wouldn't necessarily depict, or in any other kind of period. So realism really is trying to take the kind of Hobbes view of man is a wolf to man. Of people, and really portraying that.
Yeah, there's two important things I left out. Number one, the father also swindles David of his inheritance from his mother, pretends that there was none, but there was actually a lot. And number two, they give us a discussion about the history of printing, but they only pass three pages. They don't follow the Anna Karenina method.
Oh no, that's very important. It's not like a full book.
No, it's not. which is surprising, you know. So Lucien discovers that although he's just Lucien Chardon, his mother's branch of the family were previously aristocratic, the de Rubempre. So he starts just giving himself this name that he's not really legally entitled to use and tries to get himself on in society. But it's all him caring about himself, and we watch him get corrupted. And guess who steps in? Is a certain Rastignac from Old Goryeo.
Oh.
He appears in a small role, and when Lucien goes to the theater and the opera and tries to set himself up, it's Rastignac who starts insulting him and joking about him and tearing him back down in front of everyone.
But he's famous for being, I think, one of the most portrayed characters in the whole human comedy.
Now, I've only read Old Goryeo before with him in it, and I thought he was getting corrupted, but in that book, he's a good person. But we what's happened later, you know.
I've heard it. Oh, I literally have a little lamb here coming up to me. Guys, I'm in the countryside. Interesting.
I heard some bleating.
Meh, come here. Come here. I think he has his opinions about Balzac. What do you think about Balzac? He's turning his back to Balzac. That's very disappointing.
No, I am disappointed by that. I expected better
he
from
is literally
the
walking away
lamb.
I thought so, yes, indeed. Yeah, but I think the corruption in Balzac is too much for a little lamb's heart. Yeah?
I'm going to close it with a quote. This is the moment when he gets to Paris and his mistress abandons him. What would you say, madame, of a woman who takes a fancy to a poor, timid child full of that noble faith that men later call illusions, and who used all her feminine graces, all her arts, and a fine display of maternal love to lead that child away? The rosy promises, the card houses that so enchanted him, cost her nothing. She leads him away, she takes possession of him, now scolding him for his want of confidence, now flattering him. When the child finally leaves his family and follows her blindly, she leads him to the shore of a vast sea, persuades him with a smile to set foot in a frail skiff, and sends him forth alone, without succor, to face the storm. Then from the rocks where she remains, she laughs and wishes him good luck. You are that woman. I am that child.
Very poetic. Well.
He then... So the reason it's called Lost Illusions is twofold. It's his lost illusions with life in Paris, because he originally just thinks if I write a good book, it'll get published and I'll be successful. You know, he's not trying to be a bad person. But it's also everyone else's lost illusions about him. His sister eventually realizes that he's not really a good person. His friend never does. His friend sticks with him to the end. But his sister... realizes he's just a selfish person and he's just here to fleece us.
Wow, okay.
So, awesome. Yeah.
It's interesting, okay. Well, it sounds very deep. Would like to read it. Would you say, though, it's as good as Au Pair Goryeo?
Well, I think, yes, it is as good, but it didn't make me cry the way Goryeo did. So maybe that's because Goryeo was my first, though.
Well, Goryeo as well, you see, listeners, has a huge... kind of very almost theatrical, as Alex agreed, ending. You know, sorry, I think you agree, sorry, not Alex, that it was a very theatrical ending of like 50 pages of like just mourning, kind of, you know, being a father unloved by a daughter. So it's very dramatic. So I love that. But yeah, I would like to read this one. Okay. Wow. Well, and the next play that I read was I decided to pick up old Ibsen. Not Goryeo, old Ibsen. And obviously everyone talks about him the whole time, but they always talk about Henrik Ibsen, the Norwegian playwright from the late 19th century, and August Strindberg, from the same time period, Swedish playwright, who is slightly less known now. And the thing is, I love Strindberg as an 18-year-old, and I almost maybe judged Ibsen was out reading, because I thought, no, I love Strindberg so much, and Strindberg really didn't like Ibsen. So I thought, well, there must be a reason for that, so I didn't read Ibsen. It turns out Strindberg must have been massively jealous, because possibly Ibsen might be slightly superior than Strindberg. I'm sorry. Right. I do love Strindberg, so I don't want to say superior, but I think it maybe moved me even more, his plays. So I got I had a lot of plays in Dublin, where I was staying at, because my aunt is in the theater as well, so she's had a big selection of Ibsen plays. And the first one I read was Peer Gynt, or Peer Gynt, as it say in Norwegian. And it's one of his early plays. It's not realism. He never really got into proper realism. And it's not naturalism, which is what he's famous for. Naturalism being realism, but showing the dark sides of realism, like really showing the dark sides of prostitution, incest, whatever you have, every neuro diseases. That's what naturalism is. So I read Peer Gynt, was it before that?
Mm-hmm.
And Peer Gynt is a very poetical, really romantic drama written originally in verse. So it wasn't even fashionable for the time period. It was 1860s. It was almost outdated already because romanticism finished around that time. Before that, sorry. And realism was already in trend. So he was almost like an outdated playwright giving his big shot. But I got to tell you, Peer Gynt might be one of my favorite plays ever.
Wow.
It is absolutely amazing. It is a huge, big play. So Peer Gynt is a play about Peer Gynt, who's basically kind of a farmer's boy lad. His dad kind of ran away. He lives with his mom, who's frustrated deeply with him. Because all Peer Gynt does is tell stories. He's a very good storyteller. They might be fantastic, but he manages to get away with it, no matter how fantastic they are. So that is one good thing. He's a competent storyteller, but he's never telling the truth. And the whole village starts really disliking him and going against him. And almost as a kind of revenge, he does something at the end of the first act, which is to escape with a young girl who's about to get married, only because he knows that she truly loves him but has to marry this other person, and possibly because he just wants to do something that will ultimately really annoy everyone in the village and make him the romantic hero he so thrives to be. So it's a play about romanticism, criticizing romanticism, ultimately meaning it's not a romantic play because he's an anti-hero.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the next act, he basically lets the girl go. He says, I'm not in love with you. And he kind of walks up the mountains and she's heartbroken. And you really don't like Peer Gynt because he's being a bit of a, not a very nice chap. The rest of the play becomes very surrealist almost. So it really becomes really modern, really expressionist, surrealist. And you're kind of left wondering, wow, this play must have been written in the 1920s or something, but it was written in the 1860s. And Peer Gynt, he meets trolls, and if it's reality, because he seemed to have hurt his head at one point and fainted. So when he wakes up, you're not sure if it's reality. But he seems to have met trolls and a beautiful woman that he immediately becomes very infatuated in a very sexual way, to be honest. Like he really is attracted to her. He follows her, and it turns out that she's the daughter of this troll king. So trolls are very important Norwegian folkloric creatures.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And he kind of gets arranged to be married to this beautiful girl, who turns out not to be very beautiful at all, as soon as the magic spell is broken and he sees that she's actually kind of a pig. So that's what I like about this play. It's very surreal. It's very ahead of its time. It's very visual. I do love these fairy tale. If you know me, I love all these fairy tale figures.
Yeah.
And it becomes very tragic because he somehow gets her pregnant, even though there's no scene in it at all that indicates that. Yeah, he gets her pregnant. So that's the whole kind of nature of the whole play. It's very kind of, is this a dream or not? Because at what point did anything of this happen? But he gets her pregnant and he gets a troll child. But he kind of immediately forgets about it, escapes. He barely manages to escape. And he kind of just puts it away from his mind that he ever got a troll child or that he ever got her pregnant. So now he's living, in next act, he's living in seclusion. And he's living far away from everyone. He's not allowed to go back to the town because they would basically massacre him for having kind of essentially kidnapped the first girl in the first act. So he's living a hermit's life. And the thing is, another woman appears who he actually genuinely likes. It's the only woman he likes in the play, truly.
Right.
And she appears because she's fallen in love with him and she decides to live with him. And he says, wow, I was never expecting this. I didn't think I was a good enough person because he seemed a truly innocent being. And it seems all very rosy, doesn't it, Dean? Do you think that's the end of the play?
Well, I'm sure it's not. I'm sure you're going to tell me it all goes horribly wrong again or something. But
it goes horribly wrong because the thing is, immediately as this woman appears, it seems to be an older woman with a very ugly child, is described in the play just as an ugly child, seems to have built a house behind his new built house. Very surreal. And it's actually the kind of the witch kind of troll figure, and she's now living literally behind his house, and she has their child, and she's going to threaten, like, she's blackmailing him that she's going to tell this woman about all the, you know, about his illegitimate child.
Sure.
And the tragedy is, Dean, the tragedy is you do realize as the reader that the woman is so nice that he truly loves, that you're actually pretty positive that nothing bad will happen. It's implied in the play that nothing bad will happen at all.
Really?
But he himself doubts himself. And that's a very important part of the plot. He doubts that he is good enough for any of this. And he basically punishes himself by leaving the one chance he has for true happiness and by going out into the world. And he's basically punishing himself. He's making himself again a nomad, an outsider. And this is where it becomes very interesting. I won't say too much more about the story. He basically just travels the world and has incredible, fantastic scenarios that are very almost Alice in Wonderland-esque. but it's basically, becomes very philosophical. And he talks about the self. And this is a very Kierkegaard, a very Scandinavian existentialist idea at the time in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. Mm-hmm. What is the self? And he starts questioning.
PJ, when you mention Kierkegaard, it makes me tremble.
It should make you tremble.
See what I did there?
That's very good. That's very good. So, guys, for those of you who don't know, Kierkegaard was someone who talked about the trembling, the fear of God, the fear of what you truly are yourself. Who are you? He's basically a proto-existentialist. And Scandinavian plays, especially Ibsen, were very influenced by his ideas. And the play, I won't tell too much about the plot. I hope that got you interested. But the play is then about him starting to question who the Gint self is, who is pure Gint. And truly the last scene where he's entering death's realm, it becomes very interesting. He without spoiling anything, but there is a small dilemma in the fact that pure Gint does not mind dying as long as his self goes to heaven. The thing is that he has a discussion with death. Without spoiling what happens, but he has a discussion with death, and death seems to think that pure Gint never lived his true self, that he was always escaping, mm-hmm. meaning that he will recycle his soul and turn it in and tear it into pieces and just put it into the big mishmash of recycled souls. And that truly terrifies pure Gint because he realizes he might never have lived his true potential. Sure. That's what I find very deep about the play, that you might not live your true potential, that you're all recycled material at the end. So my explanation sounds very surreal, it is very surreal, but it's the ultimate play about the horror of not living your true self. And the last scene of the play might be one of the most powerful scenes ever written in plays, in novels, in poetry. It's absolutely amazing and spellbinding. I truly recommend it. It's
okay. Absolutely, I must amazing. Give it a try. It's you've got me really hooked on this one.
Well, yeah, I think I've talked about it a bit too long, maybe perhaps, but it's just because I find it so deep, so amazing, the philosophical and also the narrative and it's my God, it's like Dr. Faustus or like Goethe's Faust in the sense that it has so many scenes. Mm-hmm. That it wasn't intended to be performed, actually. He actually didn't intend it to be performed because it would be very difficult. It has about 20 scenes or plus around the world with difference. There's a scene in it where they're in the Sahara Desert, which is very surreal as well. And this is what I find interesting, because he's actually truly letting his imagination fly because he's not thinking about the practicality of performing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is amazing. I love that.
Well, PJ, I'm going to shock you with my next one because shock horror, I read Dumas.
No, you!
Yeah, I know, right? You'd never think it. But the real shock is, I didn't like it.
What?
I finally found a Dumas I didn't like. Now, I don't know what's happening with Dumas, because again, the confusion. The book I read, I picked it up for a euro in a big bin full of books in a fair in Spain, in a warehouse or something, it's called La Hija del Marqués, so the Marquis's Daughter. Hmm. Huh. And I could not find reference to this book anywhere online. I was finding The Regent's Daughter. Turns out that's not the same book. And I was thinking, what is this book? Why can't I find it like in his bibliography? Like, what am I reading again? And it turns out that this is the second half of another book. The book altogether is called Creation and Redemption. And someone at some point split it in two and released it into two volumes.
But did you read the second part?
Yes,
part
first? Because I didn't know. So the first, because it doesn't say anywhere part two of Creation and Redemption. It just says here's a book called La Hija del Marqués. So the first part's about a doctor, and the doctor is in the second half. But it really didn't help my understanding. You know, I'm reading in a second language. I have no idea what the first half of the story is. And in the volume I had, three quarters of it is taken up with a written narrative. So what happens is there's a few short chapters at the beginning, and then she says, I'll tell you what happened. Just three quarters of like exposition in the past, and then a couple of chapters to wrap it up at the end. So like really only the first and last bit of the book were story. The rest is just a manuscript of like, here's just filling in the plot holes. Like, it really wasn't good.
Oh no, very sorry to hear that.
So the main characters are Eva and Jacques. What happens is Eva... they had been in love, but they were separated. And what little I could actually divine from the plot here, essentially, Jacques comes to her and says, like, why are you, you know, you're here, you're with another man and things like that. Just when I thought you were dead. And it turns out that they'd gotten separated. It's obviously set in Paris again. There was revolution, all this kind of stuff. Eva almost got executed herself. So there's all this kind of stuff. She assumes that he's dead. She hasn't seen him in years. And he's like, no, I'm alive. And you'd think, well, now they're back together, it's easy. No, he's incredibly cold-hearted. And he's just like, no, well, this isn't good enough. So he's kind of an ass. And then she is just super in love with him. And like, at one point they're in a, she's like, you know, if you don't want me anymore, just cast me aside, kill me. Like, I'm at your mercy, you know. Just use me as you want me and then throw me away when you're finished. And they go along in a carriage, and he's sitting on the carriage, and she's lying on the floor, clasping his knees, like, the whole journey of the carriage. Like, she is so depressingly subservient to him, to the point of ridiculousness. And then there's just this massive, massive manuscript where they just explain how she got separated from him in the first place and all this kind of backstory. And then we go to skip to the end. There's very little story. But he also recycles a plot line from one of the other books where eventually he takes her to a wedding and she doesn't realize it's her wedding because he's still being mean and cruel to her the whole time. And it turns out they're only going to get married. It's somehow that makes it all fine, you know.
What?
So it's not the easiest thing to read, and it's also not the most enjoyable. But just her level of... I mean, at one point, they lay the table for food and she says, why is the table only laid for one? And she says, well, I didn't think I was good enough to eat with you. You know, and it's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God.
Just like that level is ridiculous, you know.
Doesn't sound like the Dumas book I'd like to be reading.
It's definitely not. I mean, of all the Dumas that I've read, it's the first one I haven't liked. And I have to be honest. I love all the Three Musketeers stuff. I love The Count of Monte Cristo. I enjoyed The Black Tulip there last time. This was not good.
Oh, no. Very disappointing.
Like, maybe if I'd read part one... it would have informed part two a little bit better and I would have known what was going on. Presumably Jacques was the doctor. You know, maybe if I knew a bit more of the backstory and I wasn't starting halfway through, maybe that would have helped. Like, it's not fair of me to kind of dismiss it having only read part two. But really, this wasn't good.
Oh, no. Well, I'm very sorry to hear that. But to be fair, now you have got a lot of Dumas books still to read, especially from the time in County Clare. So maybe the next ones, and I'm expecting going to read another one for May.
I think there'll be another year. There'll be a Dumas, there'll be a Balzac, all the usual, you know.
But why don't we just call this the Dumas, Balzac, and some other, like, you know, just some other authors not worthy mentioning. We'll just call it that.
Because this is my last month in the library, I've taken out 3 Balzacs. Now, I'm not going to do them all in the next episode. That'd be crazy. But I met Alex last night at a cafe, and he was like, oh my God, are you going to do all these Dumas on the next episode of Books Boys? I said, no, I'll just return them late. It's fine. I'll split them up over 2 months, you know?
Oh my God.
So, anyway. Yeah, look, I don't have a lot to say about this one because out of 350 pages, 250 of them are just manuscript. So, there's really very little to go on, and what was there wasn't great, and was, I didn't know the beginning, so like, I didn't like it. That's all I can really say about this one.
Oh no, so very disappointing. Even if you're a fan of Dumas, so you're saying it's not really worth reading? Oh no,
I don't think so, to be honest. I would give this one a miss. There's plenty of great Dumas. This should not be on your to read list.
Well, what about the next quote? And you might recognize this. You have never loved me. You have only thought it pleasant to be in love with me.
Oh no, we're back in the doll's house.
This is Henrik Ibsen back again. And this is something the Playboys read. So we got an episode all about the doll's house. And it's on Patreon. Now, I love it. It's very different. After Peer Gynt, Ibsen decides to let go of drama in verse and starts writing drama in prose. And in fact, it changes completely because it only has one scene in it the whole time. So that's already one aspect of naturalism. So just taking one scene in drama. Strindberg does the same with Miss Julie around the same time period, a bit afterwards. And it's set in one scene, and it's basically just... it sets throughout Christmas, so a few days. So again, very realistic enough, naturalistic, and it depicts naturalistic traits, which are not betrayal. Betrayal, I would say, but also what goes on financially with people who seem very rich, but maybe one of them did a shady deal. And that's essentially it. And it talks about veneer disease very indirectly. But he does it. It's more explicit in his later plays, but there is a doctor in it who's implied that he's got a venereal disease from his own father. And that was a huge, I was reading about, that was the ultimate scandalous thing to talk about at the time.
Well, yeah, I would have thought so.
But even a lot more than now, but this is just like the ultimate thing. So we won't get too much in it, Dean, right? Because we did a whole episode about
it. Yeah, we've got a full hour and 10 minutes on it.
But it's essentially about... essentially about a character called Nora who helps her husband, who's in a lot of debt, become a established member of society only by making herself be in a lot of debt. But no one knows about this except her and one or two other people. And it's essentially about during Christmas period, events happen that might lead to her husband finding out about her having borrowed so much money. And he works in the bank, so it'll be a big double scandal. And she's worried that she might have to commit suicide because he implies the whole time that he would never have anything to do with such horrible figures, and they would never have a mother who would lie. And it's essentially about
that. I should say, guys, because you've never heard us, like, we've disagreed on one or two things, minor.
Yeah.
But like, if you want to listen to the episode, the three we really debated on the end here. We spent a good half hour because we massively disagreed on how the play ended. You and Alex were more or less of a similar opinion. I was quite of a dissenting opinion. So it's interesting to listen to, maybe slightly chaotic, more chaotic than the usual Shakespeare review, but it's one that might be interesting to check out.
I thought it was good. If I may say something, you were a bit worried that it was maybe a bit too emotional and chaotic. I think that's the whole point. This is one of the most scandalous plays ever performed at the time, and it led to a huge amount of discussion in Norway and outside it. And the fact that we perhaps were very civil, but I think it was quite passionate debate, very philosophical. It was all about the ending, which we can't tell. But essentially, that's all we're mentioning about it. I do want to mention the next play that I read, which was Ghosts, which is basically a spiritual follow-up of A Doll's House, which made Dean not want to read it because it's so dark, I suppose. It has similar themes in it, except the venereal disease becomes a bigger issue.
Right.
Includes the falsity of religion. Incest becomes a huge thing. There are two siblings in it.
Flowers in the Attic type stuff here.
Flower in the Attic type stuff. It truly is, yes. And Euthanasia, which was something that I don't think was ever mentioned before.
I can't cope with dark themes, BJ. I just need a Dumas-style romance, and that's all I can cope with, you know?
Well, that's why I find interesting about Ibsen, because Peer Gynt is not at all like that. It has some philosophical issues, but like Ibsen seems to be really deeply upset with society, and it seems to go one step ahead with goals. And really, it's about a young artist coming back to his mother's home, and as the father died, but there's something wrong with the artist. He's sick, and I can't say why he's sick, but you might guess what is wrong with him. I just mentioned it. And the dilemma is that the husband seems to have had a very immoral life, and has had sex with one of the maids, who's given a daughter who's essentially the maid. Right. That's actually spoiling perhaps one or two things about, but I think that's the whole point of the play is there seems to be a lot of siblings falling in love who don't know their siblings and dying of venereal diseases. And yes, and it's called Ghosts because she's worried that the brother is going to have sex with his sister because she's worried that this ghost, she's worried that the artist who looks like her husband is going to have sex with the maid. So it's kind of like history again telling itself. I don't want to mention too much about the play because that's it. And
but it's a spiritual sequel, right? Like there's no overlap with characters or anything.
Not at all. And there are a few plays I think written between that, but it's almost as if the end of Dote's House, you know what the ending is?
Yeah.
This is like 10 years later. All right. And she's now, because she is the main character. It's the very feminist characters, Ibsen's, but only really at the end of Dote's House. And now the main character of the widow, Miss Helen Alving from Ghost, is a really feminist character. But the thing is, the mistakes she did as a younger woman have led to some serious difficulties now. And it seems to implicate that if anything, a woman should be a feminist early on, because if you leave it too late, your children might also be suffering from dire consequences. Mm-hmm. And essentially, everyone's life is absolutely ruined at the end of the play. Absolutely. Aww. Devastating. It's more dramatic than Shakespeare. This is like truly, the ending is the most vicious scene since A Requiem for a Dream. And I'm not sure if anyone should see that film, but that's a very vicious scene. And this is truly, it goes close to that level of, come on, you can't do this. And it was such a big scandal, Tom. Again, it was such a big scandal that I believe Ibsen had an interview, this is just maybe folklore kind of legend, but Ibsen had dinner with the king of Sweden and Norway. And the king told him that Ghost wasn't a good play. I'm imagining the king like signing, going to Ibsen saying, Ibsen, Peer Gynt, I like that. Ghosts, not a good play. Give it a better try. And then supposedly Ibsen tried to retain himself until he exploded and said, Your Majesty, I had to write Ghosts. And I like that story because the whole point is, I think, yeah, you had to write Ghosts because this was happening all over the world. And no one ever wrote about venereal disease or the possibility of euthanasia. Someone who's suffering might... one of the characters, he really wants to die because he's in pain. And it's like one of the characters left in dilemma. Well, can this character kill this other character? No. So it's a play about morality. And as Nietzsche would say, dead morality, you know? So, I mean, there's a reason why these characters appear, like Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and Ibsen and Strindberg, who all criticize society around the end of the 19th century. It's really become outdated. It's time to create new values that are just better for society without all this pain.
Okay.
So that's Ghosts. Highly recommend it.
PJ, you've read some dark stuff. Do we need an intervention? Do you want me to send you some more Dr. Seuss?
Well, yeah, we reviewed a lot of Dr. Seuss, didn't we? To be fair, I did actually read a Dr. Seuss book as well to lighten things up. Good Lord, I did read a lot.
I think you need it.
I think I need now. To be fair, now the next two things I'm going to review are a lot lighter. So
good. Well, the next one I did again. This is going to be pretty brief, because this one isn't. Well, I could say it's not a book. It is a book. It's not a novel. So I read by Robin Raven, The Kindness Workbook. So Robin was kind enough, there's a little pamphlet there, she was kind enough to send me a copy of this, and along with, like, there's a nice little bookmark and a couple of bits and pieces, and that was very, very kind of her. She is an author, you know, so this is a workbook rather than a novel, but she has written other books before, particularly children's books about kindness. Santa's First Vegan Christmas was the one that I can remember offhand. So she has written things like this, and it's, you know, she does like to teach children about kindness. This one is for adults, though, and this is, as I say, not a novel, but a workbook. So it's split. You're not supposed to sit down and read this in 2 days or something. It's exercises to do, maybe one a day, something like that, ongoing. And some of them might say, you know, over the next couple of days, do this thing. And so it is something to do a few minutes each day as an ongoing exercise. But part one is about being kind to yourself, and part two is about being kind to others. Okay. And as it's a series of exercises, sometimes you have to draw things, sometimes you have to go out and do things, sometimes you just have to maybe question your values, think about, are you being too hard on yourself? Talking about empathy, there's some meditation mentioned in there, just giving yourself a break, all this kind of stuff, what are your goals in life? And then focusing on others, you know, your relationships, because you've got to be kind to yourself before you can be kind to others, I guess. So that's why it's structured this way, you know?
I see, yeah, of course.
And maybe you got to do a flow chart of, like, what is it to make, you know, to do good actions and design your kindness coat of arms. Just different things to get you thinking about the types of values, the type of person you want to be, and how you can be happier, essentially, by living a life filled with kindness, both for yourself and for the people around you. And I think it's quite good. I think it's a really helpful thing, especially for someone that maybe feels they need a bit more kindness in their life. This is something I think that would help a lot of people.
Definitely. Yeah. It sounds very useful. Wow.
And that's it. I mean, there's one move past the bystander syndrome, this idea of something happening and we kind of freeze and we don't really want to get involved, you know, go do it, help someone, you know, just things like this. But as I say, each day, there's a little thing, you fill in a little bit of the workbook, you do a little exercise, you have to think about the, you know, the both sides of an argument, or how could you help someone in a certain situation. It's just help, you know, nice memories, even kindness bingo. There's lots of different things in there just to get you thinking and get just increase the levels of kindness in the world. So very utilitarian book in that sense, you know, it's about increasing the overall kind of goodness in the world.
Well, I love the idea. I mean, if everyone studied at school, for example, you have better individuals. So it's the kind of thing that's needed. It reminds me a bit of the Tao Te Ching as well, where you meditate on specific verses. That's good. I like it.
Yeah. So that was great. And thanks very much to Robin for passing that one on to me. I'm just going to pass the books that I've read back over to little Alfred. He's here with us. And he can pop them away back on the shelf.
Might be a bit lazy.
Well, PJ, back to you, I guess.
Back to me then. Hold on a second, Dean, if you don't mind. Just give me a wee pauser. All right, dude.
Okay. But I think, PJ, before we get back to you, I'm just going to reiterate. Guys, we mentioned our patreon.com/booksboys. Get all the other shows. But we have other things you can do. So if you go to booksboys.com, you get links to all our different projects. For example, there's a link to PJ's project with his partner Elisa, The Holy Wholesome Life. There's a link to our Spotify where you can get some of the music that we've made. So there's a lot of different things to explore on there. And you know, even better than, well, not better, because we do want you on Patreon, but what you can also do to help us is just spread the word, you know, tell other people to listen to the Books Boys. We're here getting it, buying it, and booking it, you know.
Tell the kids where the cool kids hang out, you know, that kind of thing.
I've been working my Books Boys.
It's a kind thing to do.
It is. I've been walking around town today with my booksboys.com t-shirts, just as a walking billboard, you know?
Because that's what the cool kids do anyway, right?
It is. So. The cool kids, they love advertising and capitalism, but then we're no one. So it's capitalism because it's advertising, but no one makes any money. So I don't know how that works.
Oh my god. And he talked about some other t-shirts, because the phrase "is this a holiday" has become quite the latest thing with Shakespearean.
I'll have to have a look. Yeah. So on Patreon, guys, you can get a Books Boys t-shirt. But as PJ says, I'm going to have a look and see if we can add an alternative option. And is this a holiday t-shirt?
Well, make it a thing, guys. You know, it's the masses that make the things can happen, right? So like, if everyone gets to get into the...
That's it. No, that's grand. And you know, the other thing you can do is follow us on the social media. Do you know we hit 1,000 followers on Instagram just a couple of days ago?
Wow. Okay. They seem to like references a lot.
Yeah, we did a lot of videos. So when we were in the beach and in the forest, we did lots of photos and lots of videos. And those videos are all getting, you know, 20,000 views and things on Instagram. They're becoming very popular. So.
No,
just ask, you know, is this a holiday in various exotic locations?
Blatant lie, actually, just because I'm afraid the next thing I read wasn't really much lighter.
Oh no!
And seeing that you're such a big fan of comics, Dean, I decided to mention it. It's called Hans. Hans is belongs to the Franco-Belgian school of comics, which I often mention, and Dean seems to have no respect. Shame on him. But it's basically the guys who did Tintin and Lucky Luke and the Smurfs, all that kind of stuff. Classic non-Disney, the alternative to Disney in Europe, I suppose. And this comic was created by Grzegorz Rosiński, who did the drawing, who's a famous Polish artist as well. And also written by Andrzej Paul, famous for the Torgau series later on in the 70s. But this comic came out in 1980. And I just want to briefly mention it. It's a beautiful comic, beautifully written, beautifully crafted. And I read it in Polish because it's not released in English.
Oh, right.
So again, I'm afraid I'm like once again advertising for something that's never been released in English.
I think people think we're awfully pretentious because we're recommending books they can't read, you know?
Well, no, but it's a great comic. If you read in other languages, doing the original Francais. Yeah, okay. And I seem to be making worse with the pretentious. I'm telling them to read in French. So again, but it's a great comic, even just by looking at the pictures. It's set in an alternative future. Alternative future, Jesus. It might actually happen this future. It's set in around the 2020s, I think. And it starts off with a place called, simply, The Place. It's literally, that's the beginning of the comic. It says, The Place, known simply as The Place.
Right.
And known because it's known in this times because it was known in this time as the last colony of people. I'm just translating it here a bit. And it starts off with the place, which is a very kind of looks just like a small mountain. And basically, they're just kind of living there in this kind of being distracted by entertainment and by circus a lot. And they don't seem to be doing much anything apart from just enjoying this rubbish kind of entertainment crew. Kind of gladiator like entertainment, because the slaves are basically people. Anyone who's living outside the place has no rights. It's not a, so it's very much divided. Anyone living on this little mountain called the place and everyone who lives outside who doesn't want to conform to the rules. And these are just people who are there to be captured, to be used in kind of circus gladiator events and to kill each other off. So I'm afraid, guys, yeah, maybe not the lightest read.
You tricked us there, you see.
Yes, I'm afraid. Well, it was the comic, I suppose, right? It starts off with a chap called Hans, called in the Polish version, Jans. And he appears in the middle of the desert, and all he can say is, my name is Jans. And he's suffering from amnesia, and he doesn't know how he appeared. Yet the clothes he's wearing is from the late 90s.
Uh-huh.
Bearing in mind this was written in the 80s though, so literally it's kind of already there are about three time periods in this comic on a future. And essentially he's suffering from amnesia and he's being tested, and you know they're very confused where he comes from, why is his clothes, there's no such thing as time travel, That doesn't exist. So they're just very confused because they're living in this world that's post-apocalyptic. Dinosaurs have been born again. They've did some biological mistakes, and now they're like big creatures kind of eating human beings. And I this might sound very cheesy, but I think it's just great. And they essentially go back to the place where they found him. Dilemma is there's a dinosaur there that attacks, and Jans or Hans defends himself very skillfully and attacks the dinosaur in the only vulnerable place it could be attacked. And because of this, the two soldiers accompanying him think he's a spy, because they're wondering how did he know this, because that's only classified information. And they want to attack him, but before they attack him, they get attacked themselves by non-citizens, by people living outside. And basically these non-citizens, they save Hans, and he begins to live as kind of a tribe. And it's very kind of like Bronze Age-esque kind of culture, I suppose. And he falls in love with Orchidea, is her name in the Polish version, or Orchid. Sure. And they fall in love, and the thing is that he gets recaptured. He gets betrayed by one of the members. And when he's back at the place, he realizes that when he goes to one of these circus events, that Orchid has also been captured. So he decides to save her, and they both escape from the place together. And without spoiling too much, there's some weird things happening then, because they try to look for the sun, which is being hidden away. And when they reach the place where they think the sun is, they end up in a place where a place controlled by robots that basically that take possession of their bodies.
And so it's getting a bit sci-fi there, a bit crazy.
Yes, and the illustrations become very sort of like, is this the cover of some kind of Beatles hippie album? That was
PJ, if there's one thing I love more than comic books, it's sci-fi and robots, you know? So.
Well, it's great, basically, because the whole comic is just about them escaping and trying to find some place where they're not going to be captured, and he falls in love with Orchids. And the thing is, he begins to recapture his memory, and it turns out that he was a historian from the future, time traveling for research. And so he comes from the future, time traveling for research, and it's unclear though why he's got these. So you're left with some confusion at the end.
Okay.
And I know it's very random, just mentioning this comic, but I just highly recommend it. I'm going to send a picture later of it. And I think for those of you interested, this is a great, unusual find.
Okay. Sounds interesting. It sounds, at least it's something that people won't have already heard of, which is good, you know?
Yeah, and it's called Passenger from the Future, it's called. And it's just a great story. It's not... I was surprised how kind of detailed it was. You know, this is not at all a kid's comic book. This is just... It's too dark.
If you'd like to sign up for Patreon and get us some money, I will put together a care package of happy children's books, and I will send them to PJ. Because he's reading some very dark things this month, and I am worried.
So anyway, guys, so check it out. Jans or Hans. Great comic book.
Cool. That sounds good.
Okay.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.